You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, June 27th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, ladies and gentlemen. But Cliff Schechter has gotten so casual, he's on vacation. Joining us today, the great Guy Lawson, Rolling Stone reporter, author, The Octopus, multiple books, new one coming out. Also joining us from Lawyers, Guns, and Money and the American Prospect, Scott Lemieux, on two of the Supreme Court rulings that dropped this week. And the FBI sniffing around Rupert Murdoch. I don't think his troubles are over, ladies and gentlemen. Chris McDaniel. Is it possible that he committed the same voter fraud he charges all those irregulars did?
I think in the word irregular, Sam, you demonstrated that I did not. Point being,
I'm a white man. Americans apparently not so great on their political knowledge. Fox, once again, has found the key to what's really going. I don't even know how to say that. A new report out warning us of the possibility of forever war. War without end. This time it comes from those dirty hippies who were former generals and officials at the CIA. All that and more, ladies and gentlemen, on Casual Friday. Hey, just a reminder. This show cannot exist without your support. It is the members that make this show possible day in, day out. As a way of thanking you, we give you 40 or 50 minutes of extra content, depending on the day. Sometimes even more. I keep getting corrected. But regardless, if it wasn't for the members, we wouldn't be able to do even the free part of the show on a daily basis. Members make up 98%, 99.9%. We don't have the resources to actually run the real numbers of our revenue. And so when you become a member, what we will do, of course, is to hire some forensic accountants and who will tell us exactly how much.
Become a member so we can authoritatively manipulate you.
That's right.
To become members.
That's right. Well, it's not manipulation. I mean, let's face it. You like
it's just the truth.
You go to get a coffee every day, you pay for the coffee. You don't have to pay for this, but if you want it, you want to make sure that that coffee store is still there.
You don't have a nice cafe where people say, "Hey, have free great unlimited coffee, and if you give us $10 a month, we'll take you to the back and give you some extra espresso." That doesn't happen.
I don't even want to get involved in what you're talking about.
You don't
about.
Get that. All right.
You've been listening to too many of those Fox clips. All right, folks. The point is also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. use the coupon code MAJORITY. You go to justcoffee.coop. But yes, it is your memberships that make this show possible. If you have the financial wherewithal, please
Majority.fm. Become a member. We'll be right back with Guy Lawson. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, this next man needs no introduction, yet I still feel compelled to give him one. He is a writer for the New York Times. The writer of the New York Times, the Rolling Stone. I should say he is the writer of a New York Times bestseller, Octopus, the story of Sam Israel. He, of course, is writing another book, which he'll tell us in a moment, but he's also the writer, the author of The Brotherhoods, Rules of the Game, on and on and on. Ladies and gentlemen, Guy Lawson.
Sam Cedar, how are you?
I'm doing well. And I will also say this, that despite the fact that yesterday we had an extended interview on neoliberalism and how it is it crept into our everyday practices as manifested by the notion of Facebook being a means in which to remake ourselves as a way of getting likes. I know of no man who remakes himself less for those purposes than Guy Lawson, but is so deserving of likes on Facebook. So, folks, I promised him at least 7 new likes on Facebook today. Do it now. Go to GuyLawson.com.
This is as abject as like an NPR call, you know, where they don't do the programming. They just have the fundraiser.
That's right. That's all we're going to do. And so, Guy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Guy, now, I you know, obviously this week, Thad Cochran beats Chris McDaniel. A big story. I feel like it's been talked to death. Do you have anything to add on that accord?
Well, the African-American vote in that state was offered a choice. Do you want a slave owner or a bigot?
There you go. And they went
went for the bigot.
They went for the bigot or was it basically
I get, or maybe it's both.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a hard question. Maybe like the sort of the former you know, so I think Thad, I don't know, a reformist, maybe slave owner. And,
I mean, the choices in this in that kind of election. I mean, I just you just sort of imagine it from a person who's has interests other than like whether the GOP is Tea Party or just corporate crazy.
Right. And at the end of the day, they decided let's not vote for the guy who. Who's affiliated with the KKK? That's probably not a good use of our votes. All right, yeah. So that sums it up for me, Guy. I really want to talk to you about this story that apparently just broke in the the Daily News. I guess this was yesterday. What is that?
The not just IME, but the Mississippi Tea Party leader who was involved in that break-in, Mark Mayfield in Mississippi, he just committed suicide.
Oh, my God.
Jeez Louise.
Wow. All right, well.
Really?
Sorry to disrupt. It's kind of a sad Baroque note there, but yeah.
Guess yeah, he wow. was really bummed about that loss.
Well, I mean, it's not a game, right? Things, you know, it's all sort of bantery and stuff, but. I mean, that's one of the things about American politics in this age. You know, there's like it's sort of separating itself from life as it's lived. You know, like Barack Obama's, you know, a terrorist, an enemy of the state. People get themselves very hysterical about stuff.
I sort of know some people a little bit involved in Republican politics, and they wanted to really destroy this guy's life in every.
Chris McDaniel.
No, not well. This guy, Mark Mayfield, specifically. Oh, I don't know, but maybe McDaniel too. But they got him. I mean, they already have him on criminal charges. I think he was facing, you know, life wreckage in a pretty significant way.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a segue to Rupert Murdoch, if ever I've heard one, Sam.
Well, yeah. Let's talk about Rupert Murdoch here because earlier in the week, Rebecca Brooks was found not guilty and. Let's just start with this. She, on Thursday, yesterday, she apparently had something to say about that. She said, and you tell me, you are, a former or maybe a, former member of that empire. I know you have some type of multi-citizenship, but you tell me if this is just a weird phrasing and, or sort of something British or not. She broke her silence on Thursday saying, I am innocent of the crimes that I was charged with.
Right. Yeah, there's a lacuna there, right?
I mean, is she suggesting that perhaps
a lifetime? You know, the story is that hundreds of pages of emails involving Rupert Murdoch have been sent by the FBI to the United Kingdom authorities, and of course implying that the FBI has been looking at Murdoch on a criminal level. And the thing about Rupert Murdoch, like if you're only going to know one thing, is that his whole life story has been about personally destroying, leaving in wreck anyone who's his enemy, political, business, personal, and that the whole model essentially of Fox Media began its sort of nascent its roots are in Australia in the 1970s, and if you got a minute, I'll tell you I think maybe an interesting story about that.
Please,
there was a prime minister named Gough Whitlam was elected in 1972 or 3, and Whitlam was the first left of center prime minister in Australia in decades. It had been run basically like a Franco kind of one party state, and you know, he was this intellectual, dashing kind of a figure, something like Pierre Trudeau, but much more open to leftist and anti-corporate ideas and indeed national security stuff. Like, he began to dissent from the American consensus about, you know, Vietnam and the communist threat in throughout South Asia. Essentially, it was an alternative voice in world politics, especially in like what they call the five ears or the five eyes. You know, these countries, if people remember the NSA story when it broke for Edward Snowden, five English-speaking countries have this, you know, secret pact. That's United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And it happens that I'm like belong to every one of those countries. You know, I was born in one, educated in another, live in another. You know, I mean, my mother's from another. So Whitlam had this alternative worldview, and Rupert Murdoch stoked up this fake personal crisis and had his mental health put in question. Essentially, Rupert Murdoch undid an election of a national government in Australia by using personal destruction. So when you see these headlines, I mean, and it worked, right? And so that's when he moved to the UK in triumph, and it brought his tabloid way of covering politics and celebrity, and again through personal destruction made his billions, and then came to America. He's like, you know, he's like a kind of, I mean, I don't want to say it because it sounds so awful, but there's something cancerous about what he's done to really the life of Western society. And I've seen it up close. I have friends who are very close to him and his family, and you know, so when you see this 82-year-old guy, which is the next round, he's now not allied with any particular party. He doesn't have a Tony Blair to save him,
right,
or a Margaret Thatcher, because David Cameron has been so badly bruised through this Rebecca through this trial with the conviction of his former press aide, a guy named Andy Coulson. You know, you're going to see Murdoch, I think, perhaps, at the end of the day, you know, have to face some of the consequences for some of the things that he's done. But, you know, it's a good analogy, I would say, and again, this is, like, obviously hyperbole, and I don't mean to imply that he's, you know, this is literally so, but it's something like a serial killer getting caught, but after he's murdered 45 people.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, you know, okay, you stopped him, maybe, but what about all those lives that he's torn apart, all the damage that he's done to so many, just countless numbers of people have suffered the kind of thing that Mississippi politician who just, you know, that person who just killed himself. I mean, Murdoch just went around destroying people like Shiva.
It would be an interesting sort of, I guess, thought exercise, you know, to sort of see the world, these, you know, the five eye worlds, I guess, you know, the those countries that share intelligence. The counterfactual, if there was no Rupert Murdoch, I mean,
right.
I don't know how much of the tabloid. I'm not familiar enough with the history of tabloid journalism in Britain to know whether or not he drove that, or was just simply whether he's a but for type of figure.
No, he is a but for. He's a but for. He transformed it. I mean, there was a tabloid culture in the UK, and it was. But the Australian point of view really altered that landscape significantly.
Well, what's wrong with Australia that it bred something like that? I mean,
it's a strange thing, you know, and yet, paradoxically, some of the best journalists in the world have come from Australia. There's really great guys, a guy named John Pillager. My mentor was a guy named Murray Sale. You know, it's funny. There's something at one and the same time kind of anti-establishment and sort of more vicious, more kind of like willing to get down and dirty about the Aussies.
Well, I consider
the Aussie point of view like fundamental to my journalism because it, you know, it just begins with the idea of, you know, F you.
Well, you know, that was and as you know, I spent about a year there. Now it was, I guess, oh God, 25.
Don't even say it, Sam.
Yeah, a long time ago, 25 years ago. But there were two things that I noticed about Australians. One was that they were, your average Australian was far more aware of what was going on in terms of national politics, i.e. Australian politics, and international politics, than your average, even well-educated American. That was the first thing that I was aware of.
I would agree with that, yep.
And the second thing was that notion of like the tall poppy syndrome.
The tall poppy syndrome.
Are you familiar with that?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I lived there. I went to university there. I lived there for 7 years.
Well, explain it to people, because I think that's the attitude you're talking about to a certain extent, where it just doesn't I don't know if it still exists, but there was a sort of a fundamental, I don't know if resent is the right word, but just sort of sense of like, you're getting a little big for your britches.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, you know, a poppy seed growing above the levels of any of the other poppies in the field gets its head chopped off. And so the idea is that it's a leveling. And it's, you know, it's laden with myth, but there is some element of truth to it, at least in terms of attitude. And, you know, this is why in Aussies, I just had my uncle come through from Australia like a week ago, and he just couldn't get it. He's like, you know, you Americans are pretty bloody conceited, aren't they? And I didn't know what to say. I mean, of course, I mean, and I sound like an American now because I've been here for so long. A lot of it is self-flattering, you know, like Aussies like to think there's a fair go and all that stuff. But Rupert Murdoch,
he sort of exploited that, right?
Yeah, totally exploited it. And for his own purposes, you know, the thing about Murdoch is, if you scratch anything that Murdoch's touched, it's always his own self-interest that's at stake. So Fox News, what's that about? You really think that's about, like, you know, American politics? It's about money.
Right.
It's about making money. And, you know, it's like Bill O'Reilly and giving these guys, they're venting out. I mean, I'm sure that Rupert Murdoch shares their reactionary white supremacist politics, but, you know, at the end of the day, Murdoch has always been willing to destroy or abuse anyone. I mean, he broke up with his wife of 30 years in a memo. That's for real.
Was it a one-page memo or a multi-page
kind
memo?
Of thing? You know, it was an email, and you knew. I knew. I mean, I can't say like I'm Mr. Soothsayer, but I knew that something was really wrong. When you remember his then wife Wendy Deng, is now, I think they're divorced, but at least estranged wife, jumped somebody in the court, in the hearings in London, and tried to like gouge their eye out and stuff.
Yeah.
I knew. I mean, look at it. That's the kind of like thing where this was always aiming at Murdoch.
What do you mean? I'm not sure.
But I mean, this whole tabloid spying on people, knowing people's secrets, reading their emails, listening to their voicemails, that's been Rupert Murdoch's business model forever.
Right.
How do you control Gough Whitlam in the 1970s? You find out his personal information and you leak it, or you make it up.
Right.
Drug dependencies, affairs, whatever. You make him seem like a crazy person. He went to see a psychiatrist, or he didn't. And, you know, Prime Minister can't be trusted with national secrets. You whip up hysteria.
It's interesting because, you know, in that piece today, the emails have been shared with British prosecutors, according to the Daily News, but they were not used as evidence in the trial of Brooks and former News World editor Andy Coulson. I can't quite make out what that means. I don't know if that means that they requested the emails and they just weren't necessary, but Scotland Yard has advised Murdoch that it wants to interview him under caution, which is a warning that's given to suspects. I don't know what to make of this. I would imagine if the FBI has these emails, they were engaged. I know they were engaged in a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act investigation. It's unclear whether or not there's anything there, right? I mean,
it will emerge. I mean, you know, it happens that I'm a former lawyer and I went to school in the UK, so I happen to know about English law, and criminal matters are, you know, I would say much more narrowly defined. Trials do not get sort of free ranging as they can sometimes in America. So I'm going to guess that the judge just didn't want to hear about Murdoch. He wanted to hear about the defendants.
Interesting.
But that this evidence was known to the parties, and just sort of everyone was waiting for this trial to end, and then out it comes. So, you know, that would be my guess, is that judges in the United Kingdom are not elected like they are appointed through political process quite the same way. So I think there's more independence, and I don't know. I mean, it's nobody's idea of a great legal system, but compared to like the chaos that can be in America's system, I think that's probably what it's going to wind up being.
All right, so let's turn for a moment because, you know, there's that level of journalism where it was almost like he was some type of virus that came from a different planet and landed in Australia, where that virus was sort of just everybody had a susceptibility to this because there was just no sense of that you would do this. I mean, I think I've told you the story and this audience the story of when I was in Australia. The way I made money was I stumbled on the fact that movie theater chains would sell coupons of 11 movie tickets for 80% of the price it would be, or 70% of the price it would be if you bought them individually. And I was like, this would never happen in America because someone like me would come along, buy the pack of 11, and then go back into line and sell them, basically arbitrage.
What would happen in America is someone would do it on a massive scale and turn it into a Ponzi scheme.
Yes, it would be an app by now, but but that's what I did, and that was basically the way that I supported myself traveling around Australia.
Pretty clever, man.
But it was like I felt like I was somehow unleashing this sort of – that's something that would never happen in the United States. And I would go up, and at first I thought like the movie salespeople would be like, you know, they'd try and, there'd be some security, that would attack me. And I said, you know, could I at one point, like, I got enough nerve to say, like, hey, if I don't need all these tickets, could I, give one to a friend? And the ticket person was like, sell them for all we care. And I was just like, what? Okay. And I'm going to do that. And I can only imagine what Australia was like in the 70s. You know, I was there late 80s, be that as it may, the other thing that I know that you and I have talked about in the past is this sort of notion of access journalism that has made maybe it's always been a part of journalism in some respects. But it had really I know that you came across some very telling examples of this in the course of writing your book about the stoner dudes who were these huge arms dealers.
And, yeah, Arms and the Dudes.
Yes, and is that available for pre-sale yet?
No, it's publishing in April 2015. It's just going through the legal and copy edit now.
Okay.
But I'm very excited about it. They're making a movie of it, and the movie will be, is slated to start sometime in the fall.
Wow.
To be to be directed by Todd Phillips and produced by Bradley Cooper, and I'm told starring Jonah Hill, and they're trying to find the other sort of two-hander star to put in it.
Available.
Actually, I'm available. Right.
Or Saul, perhaps.
You're going to put my son in it? Well,
get him started early.
Yeah, he's still not articulating very well. But
but the point, so access journalism, when you're working a beat, it sort of becomes your job. So if you're covering a hockey team or if you're covering the White House, you know, you need to know people so they'll tell you stuff on the early side and you don't fall behind. That's all sort of, you know, baked in. But there's a more insidious kind of access that's, you know, provides you, you know, a feature interview or documents that weren't, you know, aren't being given to everybody else, that kind of thing. And that's like such a much more perilous relationship. Or no, I shouldn't say much more, it's just differently perilous. And, you know, when I was not starting out, but more than a decade ago when I was writing for GQ magazine, I did a profile of Tom DeLay, and the guy at the time was the whip, and he was, you know, crazy as a cut snake, hated the press. You know, this was the beginning of, like, Tea Party, this current version of the GOP that we've got. And so in order to get access to him and interview for GQ, I made all these promises about, you know, I wouldn't talk about this and that. And right in front of my nose, I went and interviewed the following people: Jack Abramoff, Michael Scanlon. Now, any of your listeners might recognize those names because they were, at that moment, while I was interviewing Tom DeLay for a feature, performing one of the biggest scams of the last decade in terms of political self-enrichment that wound them both up in federal prison.
Yep.
But because I was doing access journalism, I wasn't going to look at that. And I just felt like I learned an epic lesson from that about not sort of having these prior agreements and these sort of limiting the way you look at things, and that access journalism is just a really, really nasty thing. So, you know, this arms dealing book that I just completed began with a front page story in the New York Times about these two fraudsters and scammers who had allegedly defrauded the United States government by selling shoddy ammunition to the Pentagon to supply to the Afghan National Army on a huge scale, a $300 million contract, and these slimy, sleazy kids had repackaged ancient Chinese ammunition, and the poor Pentagon and the Afghans had been defrauded, and there was a whole bunch of negligence on the part of the Army, but gee whiz, aren't these kids awful? So that was the story on the front page of the New York Times. It resulted in these kids being indicted, and one of them still in prison, or convicted, I should say. They pled guilty because the weight of the world came down on them. So I initially did a feature story for Rolling Stone, which sort of covered the crazy, you know, young stoners, wake and bake, you know, selling the arms. But I knew that there was much more to it as I was working on that piece because a federal judge had put a whole bunch of stuff under seal. And, you know, defense attorneys and various people wouldn't tell me what was in it because they were bound by the seal. But there was a strong implication that there was much more to this story. So I kept persisting. I did Freedom of Information applications. I tried to get interviews. I kept going and going and going with an eye to writing a book. And then finally, I got the documents. You know, somebody decided that they deserved to see the light of day. And, you know, what do I discover? You know, I discover that, and so this wasn't in the documents necessarily, but a lot of reporting led to this. The Pentagon knew what they were buying. These kids weren't fooling anybody. The Pentagon in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2004 and 5, around then, realized that they needed to create two armies, like right away. And in order to do that, they had to get a whole ton of weapons. So there was a system set up to do that, to supply arms to Israel and Egypt and Canada and Norway and stuff. And that was the State Department system. And that required a whole bunch of background checks. And you really had to be careful and, you know, submit the right forms and everything. And the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld wasn't going to do that. So he essentially created an alternate legal reality that enabled the Pentagon to become gun runners. They could go into the Balkans and buy weapons from the same people who sell them to Charles Taylor and FARC and, you know, the Medellin cartel. You know, the Pentagon wanted Soviet-style, cheap, down and nasty weapons by the billions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so it created a legal loophole. And basically what they did was, the loophole consisted of just the omission of a few key words. All you had to say was, you know, they took out the words subcontractor, really, essentially. So the only diligence they needed to do was on the contractor, not the subcontractor. So these kids, and lots of other companies like them, big companies too, some of them, essentially became the scapegoats or the middlemen for the Pentagon to go buy from Victor Boot and this guy named Henri Tomet. Just, you know, on and on. And so none of that was in the New York Times, right? None of that context. Nor was there ever any mention in the New York Times that there was actually no issues to do with quality, that the ammo that the kids were buying was actually working fine, that the result of this investigation and the New York Times story was that they stopped all the shipments to Afghanistan, so the Afghan army ran out of ammunition in 2008, which was really basically the moment the war was lost. So, you know, I've been in this back and forth with the New York Times reporter who wrote that story, and it happens that my publisher knows him, and you know, he's an author with the same publisher, and so they said to me, as a professional courtesy, we'd like you to run these questions by him because your report's substantially different from his. And this guy, you know, first it was all on background and collegial and, you know, sure, fire me the questions. And then I send him the questions, and they're basically saying, you know, did you report on quality? Because there's no evidence that there was issues with quality. Did you, you know, investigate the Pentagon's system to set himself up as gun writers? This, you know, all these questions essentially, you know, state that I substantially differ, and I think he missed a lot of what was in the story. He went berserk. You know, he sent me an email copying the general counsel for the New York Times saying, he says, you're going through a legal review with your book, and this is how it's going to work. You will do the following. And he just basically tells me, like I'm a child, what I will do to comply with his idea of how the New York Times ought to be treated. And it's just a mountain of bullshit, excuse my language. I'm not going through a legal review. This is personal courtesy. And if you made mistakes, why shouldn't you be held accountable for them? Why shouldn't you, the New York Times, if something's wrong, be, you know, why shouldn't it be revealed? This is, you know, like Judith Miller, like someone saying, well, there's no WMD, Miss Judith Miller. And her saying, well, you can't say that about me, which was sort of like, if you remember the atmosphere at the time, you know, when the New York Times got that so epically wrong, there was a sense at the New York Times like it was unfair they were being singled out or something, that this was, you know, retro reporting. So we'll see. But, you know, the point
Judy,
Judith Miller,
incidentally, is more or less still saying that. Right?
What's that?
She's more or less still saying, like, I didn't get it wrong.
He refused to answer any of the questions. And he basically implies that I'm, you know, nefarious, conspiracy-minded, you know, delusional, whatever, you know, the terms are. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, the point, I just wrote him back and said, you know, sorry you can't answer any questions. The book publishes in April 2015.
It's incredible the level of defensiveness. I mean, because I guess basically the guy has to either say you're some type of nut job and you have no idea what you're talking about, or he has to say, yeah, I really wasn't in a position to dig too deeply because I have too many relationships that would make it hard for me to do my job in the way I want to do it. I mean, really,
well, you know, or say that I'm under the pressures of daily reporting, but the fact is, yeah, he reported this thing for 8 months. This was a big, above the fold, front page story that sent people to prison.
So, or I guess there is a fourth response. Hey, look, I just took all these guys at their word and never had an idea that they would do anything other than just tell me the absolute truth.
Well, see, I think there's a fifth thing, right? Which is, you know, and imagine a world in which this could be said. You know, I missed the story.
Right.
You know what? You're right. Look at that. Jeez Louise. Why is it that nobody in the, you know, so that the United States ships, let's call it $10 billion worth of weaponry to Iraq and Afghanistan, right? There are hundreds and thousands of reporters there, essentially covering the war from various angles. There's reporters in the Pentagon. There's reporters in the White House. There's reporters who specialize in the trade. Actually, that's really one of the funny paradoxes of all this. So when I started to report this and I started to find out, like, why is it that they're able to do this? You know, what's the legal rules here, you know, like for the Pentagon. When I talk to, like, the industry specialists, you know, like the Jane's Monthly and the, you know, gun weapon trade show magazine people, they were all perfectly not surprised, and I just thought it was kind of funny and obvious that that the Pentagon was, of course, circumventing the law and cheating and doing what it could in this way. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the mainstream media has never reported this.
I guess to a certain extent, they just never saw this influx of I guess, you know, what Chinese weapons, because they just assumed, well, yeah, of course there's Chinese weapons here.
Well, I mean, I think it even goes like it never, like, it just, it appears never to have occurred to anybody to, you know, there were some reporters, some really good reporters, too, doing stuff in the Balkans about these shady people doing business with the Pentagon and what's going on. And some of that was in the New York Times, but nobody ever sort of thought, is this an aberration or is this the system?
Wow.
Right? And it was the system. It wasn't an aberration. So, you know, to return to the idea of access, I think that access, the insidious part of access, is I think that it just, you know, in a lot of cases, it makes you not even question what's in front of you. Right? It wouldn't occur to people who depend on the Pentagon to get frontline, datelines and to get embed assignments and to be like the serious big man on campus kind of reporter to say, well, what are you guys really doing?
Right. Well, yeah, it doesn't occur to them. And it's, you know, I guess it's sort of the, it's some corollary to that saying, you know, you can't convince a man he's wrong if his pay is dependent upon him being wrong.
Right.
I've lost the actual quote, but
what you have in this case, you got to run, but it's like the Pentagon. I mean, you know, the New York Times, I think, got it wrong, and people will decide for themselves. And the point to the New York Times reporter is that it's not for him to decide what was right or wrong. It's for the public at the end of the day. You know, read my book and see what you think. But the amazing, to me, astonishing thing is the Pentagon investigation that led to the prosecution of these two kids and two others and the conviction of them, and one of them still in prison, was so epically stupid and destructive and against the war effort. And yet the guy that was behind it is not being like tearing up the you know, rising like a superstar up the hierarchy inside the Pentagon.
Wow.
It's a little bit like Petraeus, right? But David Petraeus was in charge of standing up the Iraqi army. I mean, you know, he came to his own end, but all those years he failed at it, but yet somehow that seemed to like only hasten his rise.
Welcome to we were just saying that the other day. I don't even remember what context, but Gee, I'm so excited to read this book, and I know you keep promising me I'm going to get a galley soon. So
yeah, you will. I promise, and you know, and I'm really hoping I can get 6, maybe 7 new Facebook likes, and I promise,
folks,
to keep you...
let's do this. 8 new Facebook likes on what is it? Gee Lawson on Facebook, right? Just
yeah, it's an author. It's where I'll share stuff about journalism, stories to read, and you know, important events like coming on this show.
Oh, I love it. All right, Gee Lawson, great to talk to you. I'll see you soon, buddy.
Thanks, Ed. Bye.
All right, bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Scott Lemieux about two big Supreme Court cases that dropped yesterday. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, also a contributor to The American Prospect and other places, Scott Lemieux. Scott, welcome to the program.
Great to be back.
Now, Scott, two cases dropped yesterday. I am agnostic as to which one we start with. There we have McCullen v. Coakley coming out of Massachusetts, which involves the buffer zones, and Canning v. the National Labor Relations Board. Why don't we take that one first? This is a case that is essentially about the president's recess appointment powers. Just give us some background on the case before we talk about the decision itself.
Right. So that the issue here, of course, is that as most people know, the Republican minority in the Senate was essentially serially obstructing Obama's appointees to executive agencies. And by this, I don't mean that they were just rejecting or filibustering individual nominees, but there were just agencies like the NLRB that just in principle they just didn't want to function.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, they did this for years because they just basically just trying to nullify the law, right? I mean, that's really the way to talk about it, I think, it seems.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, they basically didn't have the votes to repeal it, but they just didn't want anybody to have it. It's not that they objected to an individual. They just, they basically opposed to the idea of a consumer protection board. I mean, exactly correct. So to get around that, the Constitution has a provision which allows presidents to make, recess appointments while the Senate isn't in session. One thing I want to note here is that these appointments expire at the end of the next Senate session. So particularly for judicial appointments, it's not as if they give the president unlimited power, that any judicial appointment a president makes, the recess appointment leaves at the end of the year. So it's not as if the Senate becomes completely powerless under these, which I think is often missed here. But at any rate, the question that this case posed involved the sort of, what are called pro forma sessions. That is, the Senate wasn't really conducting business, but was essentially pretending to sort of stay open just to prevent the president from making recess appointments and filling these federal agencies. So what Canning was about was whether pro forma sessions are really sessions. And because of there was just this sort of kooky opinion by the D.C. Circuit, essentially argued that even leaving aside the pro forma question, that it was unconstitutional for the president to make any recess appointment within a broad session of the Senate at all. So that within the sort of general session of Congress, the recess appointment power never kicked in. And also the president could only fill a vacancy that had emerged during that vacancy. So effectively, the D.C. Circuit opinion would have read the recess power provision out of the Constitution, that in modern conditions there would be almost no case in which the president can make a recess appointment. So the D.C. Circuit opinion went even further than just ruling that the pro forma sessions were actually sessions.
All right, before we go forward in terms of the opinion issued by the Supreme Court on this case, had this never ever been contested before? I mean, it seems to me that maybe I'm wrong, but haven't we had recess appointments literally for hundreds of years?
Going back to the administration of Andrew Johnson, yes. And Breyer's, if you look up the opinion online, Breyer actually has a couple great appendices going through all this. And the argument is actually stronger than that because, of course, before the Civil War, essentially, there were no intra-session appointments because, the Senate basically had short sessions and didn't take breaks. I mean, obviously, in 1840, there's no air travel. The Senate isn't going to suspend business for 4 days so that people can fly home and, you have to take, horse-drawn buggies or, whatever back home. So basically, the Senate had short sessions, but it met continuously during those sessions. You know, if you're going to make a trip to D.C., you're going to make it count. So, you know, as I argued, in my writing on the case, like, to say that, you know, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson didn't make recess appointment, in-recession appointments, it proves they didn't support them. It's like saying that, well, you know, they didn't release statutes in PDF form, so it's irrelevant. That, you know,
right, exactly.
Of course they didn't make intra-session appointments. There were, you know, there were essentially no intra-session recesses. So it's just, it's a sin. And Breyer is just really, really good on that and devastating on that. So really, since there was any reason for a president to make intra-session appointments, we've been doing it. And, you know, countless attorneys general of both parties have supported that. And even more importantly, the Senate leadership, as far as I can tell, has never seriously contested it, which is really the important thing. So it's sort of amazing that nobody until, the Obama administration discovered that this longstanding practice violated the Constitution.
Wow. All right. So essentially, the court ruled that the pro forma, sessions wherein just a guy shows up, bangs the gavel, goes home for the day is basically the Senate is in session. So really what they were saying is that you have the power to make a recess appointment, but the Senate also has essentially the power of never going into recess, even though they actually are.
Right. So the court, all nine justices agreed that these appointments to the NLRB were invalid. So that the first thing is that everybody in the court said that they wouldn't inquire about whether a session was a legitimate session. So essentially, if the Senate calls it a session, it's a session.
Okay.
They won't get into it. And they also said that, 3 days was not enough to constitute a recess. So that basically, Breyer's reasoning was, obviously if the Senate breaks for lunch, that's funny,
right.
You can't make a recess appointment, so that there has to be some kind of minimum standard. And Breyer sort of said, but the key is that to the five-person majority, intra-session appointments were valid.
Yeah.
So these appointments weren't valid, but if there was a break of, say, 10 days, then that would be reasonable. So that while everybody in the court agreed about whether these appointments were invalid, there was a very sharp disagreement about whether intra-session appointments in general. And I should just explain to the listeners that intra-session just means these are appointments made while the Senate is still in its current session, as opposed to when the Senate is on break.
And session is basically every 2 years, right? I mean, is that basically,
right.
Is it the 1 year, they go on the summer vacation? What constitutes a session?
Yeah, so the session is the fall, and it generally is like it's generally a year, but the formal recess, like the end of the term, that window is becoming narrower and narrower. That generally, that as I said, that whereas in the 19th century the Senate would generally have short meetings in which they're meeting all the time, but then go. Now the Senate almost all year is sort of formally in, that it doesn't adjourn. It only formally adjourns and ends its session for very brief periods. It takes breaks within sessions rather than between them, which is exactly why this issue came up. And one important part of this opinion was that it did preserve the president's ability to make recess appointments during these sessions, and it also allowed the president to fill any vacancy. So the president wasn't just restricted to filling a vacancy that occurred during a tiny recess between sessions. Any vacancy that was outstanding, the president can fill with a recess appointment. So the majority, over the consternation of Antonin Scalia, did at least preserve those powers. So that although Obama lost the battle, he did win at least some of the war.
All right. Well, I mean, let's talk in terms of practical effect. Now, they found that those appointments to the NLRB were unconstitutional because they didn't have the president didn't have the power to make those appointments. That is sort of moot now because that's narrow issue is moot because the president has since nominated and the Senate confirmed in the new era of no filibustering confirmees. So the sitting commissioners on the NLRB are legitimate. This was sort of more of an issue of going forward. And from a practical standpoint, I mean, all those things that are retained for the president, the powers, it appears that at least the Republicans, and, you know, unless we have some, I don't know, you know, some type of gas is released people just all of a sudden start feeling good. For practical purposes, there are no more recess appointments, it would appear, right? Until the supposed fever that will never break breaks. Is that fairly accurate from a practical standpoint?
I would say to take this. So on the first point, my understanding is that that's correct, that the NLRB, now that there's a quorum, can retroactively approve all of those previous rulings so that they, you know, the rulings won't die, that the NLRB could just say that there wasn't a quorum, but we still agree with them. So I agree. As far as I can tell, there will not be any practical effect. Going forward, what I would say is that there can be recess appointments when your party controls the Senate, but not when the other party does. But as you point out, because they got rid of the filibuster, it doesn't matter that much anyway, so that there shouldn't be, with certain rare circumstances, you know, there may be some cases in which, you know, a few members of the president's party doesn't like a nominee, but, you know, something like that. But for the most part, as you say, because they've gotten rid of the filibuster, the president shouldn't need to make recess appointments. They should just be able to get their nominees confirmed. And on the other hand, when the other party controls the Senate, they could just use the loophole to just ensure that they just continue to be in session. so that the Supreme Court has allowed for pro forma sessions, so that, you know, say if the Republicans, you know, God forbid, take over the Senate in the 2014 midterms, they could just basically stop recess appointments by just, you know, continuously, keeping the Senate in session. And as I said, another important factor to consider here is that what's going to be most relevant in the last 2 years is going to be judicial appointments, and recess appointments are not really an effective tool for the president on judicial appointments anyway, since they would have to be reconfirmed after he left office. It's not, you know, so that they matter much more for executive branch appointments than they do for judicial appointments.
And, you know, I've spoken to Ian Mealheiser about this, you know, some time ago in anticipation of these cases coming down in June. And he raised the specter of that the real problem with this will be, and it's unique to the National Labor Relations Board, as far as I can tell, that it cannot function without a quorum. You know, the CFPB, you know, had an acting head for a long time, as much as the Republicans didn't want that agency to exist. Other agencies can have acting heads. It's not optimal, but it's functional. The National Labor Relations Board literally cannot function if it does not have nominees who are confirmed when the term comes up and in 5 years. So in the event that the Republicans, and I, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit, I don't know. Maybe I'm, my perspective on this is a little bit tainted, but my sense is that the Democrats will rarely use these devices, at least in the way that the Republicans do, these mechanisms. So the real problem ends up being when those National Labor Relations Commissioners terms expire, if the Republicans control the Senate, there's no way for a Democratic president to actually create a functioning National Labor Relations Board by a recess appointment. So here's the question: what is going to be done at that point? Let's say it gets to that point. What happens?
Yeah, that's a great, and, you know, and as usual, I agree with Ian on that. And that's a great question, because your point, and one thing to mention here is that, you know, one irony you note is that the effect of Senate obstructionism is just to make things less accountable. I mean, as you say, for the most part, it's not as if, you know, federal departments are just going to stop operating because they can't get a head confirmed. It's just going to be that there's just going to be an acting head who didn't get the advising consent of the Senate. So it just strikes me as a self-defeating practice, almost, you know. But with the NLRB, I think you're right that there's just there's basically a situation where when the Republican Party controls the Senate, there essentially is not going to be any enforcement of labor rights. That maybe I'm wrong about that, but I'm sort of with you. I don't really see any way around that.
Is there any theory out there? I mean, presumably, right? If I am a I'm at a company, I want to unionize. I cannot get the National Labor Relations Board to execute the National Labor Relations Act. And, you know, I am now, because of the failure of the Senate to do their job in confirming a candidate, I am now, it seems to me, I have standing to sue somebody. Maybe I sue the Senate, right? I mean, you know, have you heard any sort of legal theories as to how that type of nullification can be fought?
Yeah, we're in uncharted territory here. So that, you know, again, that this, you know, that this sort of rise of just serial obstruction, as I say, that is not merely voting against individual nominees, but simply refusing the legitimacy of an agency at all, is so unprecedented that I don't know. You know, it's going to be very difficult to mount a legal challenge just because that's what the statute requires. You know, so that one thing that we may want to consider, if, you know, the Democrats ever, you know, have a functioning majority again, is to perhaps, you know, try to modify the Wagner Act so as to, you know, create a provision for when the Senate serially obstructs nominees. I think that's what's going to have to happen. That, and there might be some political impetus to do that. That if you get a situation where the Republican Senate for an ongoing period simply refuses to confirm anybody to the NLRB, hopefully that will create an impetus for the next Democratic government to find some kind of statutory fix. And I think that's where it's going to have to come from.
So in other words,
I don't think it can be solved by the courts. It ought to be solved by Congress.
So in other words, we'll have functioning unions again when my 1.5-year-old son is old enough to join the workforce. Maybe.
Yeah, well, that's the depressing thing, right? Exactly.
Yeah, that, exactly.
You know, given the hammerlock that the Republicans have in the House, that's, yeah.
All right.
So I wish I had a more optimistic news for you, but unfortunately.
Well, maybe you can help me on McCullen v. Coakley. And so here's the big McCullen v. Coakley. To summarize, it is a case that came out of Massachusetts. Massachusetts dealt with violence at abortion clinics. They found that the bubble means of protecting women going into abortion clinics, in other words, a sort of a floating imaginary force field that could not be penetrated, legally penetrated by protesters around a woman, 6 feet, I think it was, around a woman entering into a clinic, or men, I guess, for that matter. But they came up with a solution 35 feet from a clinic. Basically, they draw a line, and that way police can make sure that nobody is crossing that line in terms of their protesting or what the Supreme Court would call counseling. And and this was struck down. First of all, talk a little bit about, and this was a majority opinion, which I find, I mean, here's the part that I can't reconcile. And people have talked about this. How is it the Supreme Court has a buffer around the Supreme Court? How is it that we have free speech pens? How is it that if you're union picketing a business, you have to be X number of feet away? I don't understand this.
Yeah, Dahlia Lithwick at Slate, who I assume many of your readers will read anyway, had a great, you know, made that point yesterday that the buffer zone around the Supreme Court is massive. Basically, the whole, you know, if anybody's ever been to the court, that whole plaza in front of the court is basically blocked off from any, you know, for reasons of decorum. And so that the reasons are actually less compelling. That with reproductive clinics, you're talking about, you know, harassment, vandalism, other things. Whereas at the Supreme Court, it's pretty much just, you know, it makes us uncomfortable when you protest, which is so the state reasons are much less compelling. One thing to mention here, though, is that what I think, and again, we have another, and this is sort of the third case I've taught you in a row, this is the case, is that although the court was unanimous in its judgment, it was very badly split on the rationale. There was a 5-4 case in terms of, you know, why the buffer zone was unconstitutional. And one thing I really want to emphasize here is that the Supreme Court did not rule that buffer zones around reproductive clinics were unconstitutional. That essentially Roberts' argument was, you know, so that in a 2000 case called Hill versus Colorado, a buffer zone was upheld. And I was concerned because basically two of the people in the majority, Rehnquist and O'Connor, were replaced by, of course, by Roberts and Alito. So there was the possibility that it could be overturned. You know, Alito pretty clearly wants an overturn, but Roberts was actually the swing vote for the majority here. And so, at least on its face, what Roberts said was that buffer zones, you know, are potentially constitutional. The state can protect access to reproductive clinics. Roberts also ruled that the buffer zones did not discriminate against anti-abortion speech, and that's a very important point, so that they're not subject to strict scrutiny, so that the argument had been that because there's a buffer zone, but employees, for example, and patients are allowed within the buffer zone, that this discriminated. And the majority said, well, no, that's silly. There's good reasons why employees can talk, you know, in front of a clinic, but, you know, not everybody can, you know, so that I want to make clear that the Supreme Court did not rule that buffer zones in principle were unconstitutional. All they said, you know, was kind of like this Massachusetts one, which was novel, just went a little bit too far. That essentially what the court argued was that there were ways of protecting access that allowed for more speech on, and there's a particular focus on public sidewalks, that kind of thing.
So what was the quality of the buffer zone in Massachusetts? What aspects of the quality of the buffer zone that made that unconstitutional, if in principle the idea of buffer zones are not problematic?
Yeah, basically, as I said, that the real key seemed to be, first of all, that the zone was a little larger than the ones that other states used. And as I said, Roberts, and there was kind of one exception that, and of course, all these buffer zones sort of depended on how exactly the clinic was configured. So that there were a couple where the clinic was set off, I think the one in Worcester where it was set off from the street, but there were the ones in Boston, I believe, were sort of right up against the street. So what the majority held was that essentially because the zone was relatively large and extended on to not just the front of the building but kind of onto the public sidewalk surrounding it, that it sort of interfered with forms that are traditionally associated with free speech, so that essentially it went further than it had to protect the legitimate interests at stake. So that was essentially, I mean, you know, what, you know, as most students of the court know, the court tends to be sort of very uncomfortable with outliers, that a lot of what the Supreme Court does is, you know, if the state is doing something differently that implicates constitutional right, it's always going to be a lot harder for the state to justify that. And that sort of seems to be what happened here. Now, I'm not really convinced by that. You know, I probably would have been a solo dissenter in this case. But having said that, it could have been a lot worse. You know, we'll see going forward. But at least, it did uphold buffer zones in principle. But that at least seemed to be the argument, that the Massachusetts one went further than other states had, and at least they didn't convince the court. And again, this includes not only Roberts, but somewhat more surprisingly, Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor and Kagan and Breyer, that it was necessary to go further than say, Colorado did.
Okay, so two things. One, I have to say this, as I'm a native, it's Worcester.
Oh, Worcester, I'm sorry.
I lived with the indignity for too long. and two, so if I understand what you're saying, that because in this instance the 35-foot buffer zone cut so deeply into the public sphere, I guess, in terms of like sidewalks, and that made it particularly onerous to free speech.
Right.
And so, okay.
Yeah, that seemed to be the logic.
And so, and they had to maintain that notion of, I mean, so back to the Dahlia Lithwick question, and that sort of, you know, my question about like the unions, how are those reconciled? Or is it just simply, is it a function of the qualitative of the size or the nature of the buffer zone, or is it because they're reconciled because of the nature of the Supreme Court or the nature of a union strike versus a business?
Yeah, it's always, you know, and again, this is sort of a very difficult, you know, that these kind of space, time, and manner restrictions are really difficult, and they're obviously sort of mostly judgment calls. Of course, the Supreme Court has never issued a full opinion about its own buffer zones, so I would love it to actually, because, you know, if you ask me, those buffer zones in the plaza strike me as unconstitutional.
Let me just explain what you mean by space.
I understand that justices need more protection than they, you know, but, right. but you know, I guess to me, I don't think you can. I don't see how that whole area around the plaza, as opposed to the interest, has to be cut off from protest. I just don't think that may, you know. So as far as I can tell, that violates the First Amendment.
All right, and let me just
I would love to know how they would.
Let me just explicate what you mean by space, time, and matter. Is that
yeah? Space, time, and matter.
Yeah. So in other words, I can protest, but if I do it at 3 a.m. in the morning, I'm yelling at the top of my lungs. I can get like a noise violation.
Yeah, that's exactly. So that the idea here is that, you know, obviously there's no question that these buffer zones restrict speech. I mean, that's obviously not in any dispute. But that doesn't necessarily end the question, because this, you know, the state is allowed to, you know, do things that burden speech, you know, in order, you know, as I say, if they restrict the space, time, and manner. So that, you know, as you put it, that's exactly right. That, you know, you have the right to express your political views. That doesn't mean you have the right to, you know, go to somebody's apartment and express them at the bullhorn at 3 a.m. You know, that, you know, localities are allowed to sort of pass things for the public order. And the two key things is that if these are going to be constitutional, they first of all have to be viewpoint neutral. That is, that they can't be so that, you know, when you know, this is what led to the letter from Birmingham jail, when you deny a parade permit basically to suppress somebody's views, that, you know, that's not consistent with the First Amendment. That these things have to be both neutral on their face and applied fairly to all sides. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that they have to be the least restrictive means. That is, the state has to show that it has no other way of accomplishing these things without burdening speech. And so what the court found in this case was that the buffer zone, even the Massachusetts buffer zone, was not viewpoint discriminatory, which is very important going forward, so that it argued that they didn't discriminate against anti-abortion speech. What they did find was that it wasn't narrowly tailored enough, so that basically the court said the state's interest in protecting women's access to clinics is legitimate. The state did not discriminate against anti-abortion speech, but it could have, you know, address these interests in ways that were not as restrictive of speech. And that's essentially what they found. So that it passed basically the first prong of the test, but it failed the kind of second, more narrow one.
Scott Lemieux, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, also at the American Prospect. Thank you very much. And, you know, it's all is forgiven in terms of the Worcester thing. I'm over it now.
All right. Thank you. I will make sure to have all of my New England pronunciations up to snuff by the time I'm
What really bothers me about it is that even the airplane code for Worcester is ORH, and there is no H in Worcester. Sorry. Had to get that off my chest. All right.
It's busy. Fair enough. I always learn something. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye. All right, folks. You know, it's just one person at a time.
You turn that into an actual thing.
If I one person at a time, if I can just educate one person at a time about the proper pronunciation of Worcester, and this whole, I want to blow the lid off this whole airport thing.
I was actually driving through Worcester a couple of weeks ago.
Should we take a quick break? Or I guess this is going to be a freebie Friday. It's going to be a freebie.
Yeah,
Friday.
Why not?
Maybe we're tight.
I used to call it Worcester.
Yeah, we're a little bit tight today on time. Obviously, we had to start a little bit early.
Is there a Jimmy song? I didn't check.
I didn't see last I checked. But
I did not see a song from Jimmy Reefer Cake.
It's been on a roll, too. It's too bad.
Okay. So, folks, I just want to touch on this here. Because, of course, you know, we have a couple of – we have 20 minutes left. And so if 15 minutes left, if we have any libertarians out there who, you know, who are really, really interested in making an argument that I feel fairly confident that they're not going to, I don't know, maybe they'll win. I don't want to discourage anybody. But, you know, so many times we have talked on this program about the minimum wage and how it's just, you can't raise the minimum wage because it will cut jobs, it will cut hiring, it will sink companies. Apparently, there is this company known as IKEA. And what they sell at IKEA is Swedish meatballs. You go and you purchase Swedish meatballs.
And they are delicious.
And they're delicious. And then, it's sort of like a side business, they sell furniture. And on Thursday, they announced that it's going to raise their minimum wage by 17%. It's a privately held company. It's going to raise its minimum wage from $9.17 an hour to $10.76 an hour starting January 1. The increase will affect about half of its 11,000 employees in its 38 U.S. stores. Half of their employees. 50% of their employees will see a 17% raise automatically. And I don't think I have that. And the question is, how could they possibly do this? How is it possible that they could do this? Olson says the chain's entry-level pay is already above the average of its competitors. But IKEA, he says, wanted to ensure that its workers receive an adequate income based on the MIT Living Wage Calculator, which estimates what a single adult should earn to afford basic expenses in each U.S. county in the country. This is disgusting. This is disgusting. I will remind you that when we had a Swede in this office, and we asked him about what does Sweden do to help the working poor, he looked at us and he said, "We don't know what that is. We don't have such a word in Swedish. There's no such thing. If you have a job, you can support yourself." So that would mean, if we are to believe what libertarians tell us all the time, that productivity is in a one-to-one relationship with wages, that he is going to have to raise prices, right?
Obviously.
Of course. Because if you take 50% of your employees and you're not getting any more productivity out of them, you have to raise prices. But Olson says IKEA has no plans to raise prices. Well, then surely what you must do is cut staff, because there's no way you could increase the pay of workers, not raise prices, and maintain the same level of employment. It's just not possible. Olson says IKEA has no plans to cut staff. Okay, well, in that case, my libertarian friends would tell me, of course, it's going to reduce hiring, because the only thing that drives hiring is not demand for product. The only thing is what you pay your employees. And if you raise the rate of 50% of your employees by 17%, then I could actually probably calculate how many people you could not hire in the future based on that. But Olson says IKEA has no plans to reduce hiring. He says the company could absorb the pay increases by narrowing profit margins.
Hey, what happened?
What? And he also argues that this is going to save us money Because we're going to have less turnover and happier employees.
I have two thoughts. One, I have not seen anywhere in reading about the CEO of IKEA, I do not see Denny's management at any point
in
that
bio. Right, he doesn't know.
So I would take everything he's saying with a significant
grain of salt.
Grain of salt, or whatever it is they put on their meatballs. And secondly, are we going to start hearing new music when we go in IKEA?
Well,
are we going to start hearing a different?
Oh yeah, here we go. Let's play the new
now
IKEA
announcement,
the IKEA theme song.
As we go into. We knew it.
Yeah,
you can never trust these suspicious Swedish stores. They're coming in. They're undermining America, the World Cup, Obama, IKEA.
Okay, stop the music. What next? What next? First, it's IKEA. What next? Is it going to be some state that just decides to raise its minimum wage to something like $11 an hour?
You know it, bro.
Dude. Massachusetts, $11 an hour.
Give us a shofar, brah.
Oh, dude, check it out. Dude, it's going from $8 an hour to $11 an hour by 2017. It's going to benefit 500 grand people. Okay? So I've done the calculations. Extra $3 an hour. It means that I'm going to be able to go out and buy that many more extra cases of Genesee Cream Ale or Busch Beer. And it's going to mean I'm going to be able to go to Ipswich and get some of those sweet fried clams. And we're going to party on the beach.
Which will, in the virtuous circle, support the broader economy. Because the dude in Ipswich who's selling me the beer. Then you got the gas to get to the beach.
Yeah.
Then you got the clams.
And dude,
more people are working. They're getting paid more. They're going to want to throw up on the beach too. Try to feel up a girl or something. It all works. It's a virtuous circle.
It's a virtuous circle. So let the party begin. And now I'm going to be able to buy that knockoff sock shirt that I saw in Kenmore Square. So,
which in turn helps that
dude,
African
I
dude.
I had an idea for T-shirts that are all bright orange, the same color as the parking tickets. And then people can walk around like I'm wearing like a parking ticket. All right, we'll talk about that later.
That's the type of entrepreneurial investment you got when people are actually making a living.
There you go. Let's
but
go to the phones.
Total mass pride.
I love it. Let's go to the phones. Calling from a 202 area code. Who's this?
Hi, Sam. It's Josh.
Oh, hi, Josh. Josh Orton, folks.
Worcester. I was not aware that your hometown was the site of the largest gathering of the KKK in New England ever. That's awesome.
What? I didn't know that.
Dude.
No.
He finally does it.
Wait a second. Worcester was the site of the largest KKK gathering in New England?
I'm not clear on your pronunciation, but I think so, yeah.
All right. I'm not even going to entertain that.
Are there three Ks in Worcester, too?
I did want to go back to the Supreme Court for a second. You know, what drives me nuts is, you know how they keep talking about, people who criticize the Robertson majority keep talking about how it's naive. They don't really understand how this stuff works, and, you know, they're not in front of the abortion clinics, and, you know, they don't run elections. Like, I think we have to stop actually giving them credit of being naive. They're just hiding their ideology. It's really frustrating.
Of course. Of course. I'm sorry. The idea that John Roberts believes that this that abortion protesters are out there counseling people is just absurd. But the only thing you can give them credit for is that the plaintiffs knew, let's bring in an 80-year-old woman or whatever she is, and she'll be soft-spoken, and how could this little old lady, she's not going to harm a flea.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that also it's a lesson in how, just as a reminder that Supreme Court justices are politicians. They're political actors, and John Roberts has cultivated a very reserved objective. You know, this is the balls and strikes guy. He's not loud or aggressive. He sort of cultivated this image as this very sort of small C conservative, quiet guy. And I think that gives him a lot of leverage to sort of pass his extremism on without being held accountable for it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but sadly, there is no actual way to be held accountable. But, it means that the next guy who looks like John Roberts, when we have a Republican president who gets up there, they're going to go, well, you know, balls and strikes guy. He's just like an umpire.
I'm like an umpire doesn't like black people voting, women harassed at clinics and unlimited corporate money in campaigns. In that sense,
I'm an umpire.
I'm like a baseball umpire.
Right.
Right. So what's the office consensus on Hobby Lobby on Monday?
You tell me. I mean, I saw somebody imply like 9-0 on the McCullen case. Maybe they're negotiating with Hobby Lobby. I don't know. I think Josh, I know you listen to the program every day. You'll recall that Haley Sweetland Edwards interview that I did regarding the use of the First Amendment as a mechanism to begin to, down the long road of saying all government regulation is wrong. This is one of those cases that really strikes me in that way. I mean, all the other implications aside, you know, this is the idea that this has to do with the First Amendment is simply a joke. It seems to me. And
yeah, I agree. And it's I think it's sort of scary, you know, just sort of putting it together. The First Amendment has used a lot, you know, there's an ideology that's basically setting up sort of a shadow government in corporate power, you know, in deciding sort of health care choices, and especially if you look at the mandatory arbitration clauses, you know, there's this sort of, you know, I don't know if it's ever put this way, but, you know, they're at once attacking the government and sort of handing over all of those normal due process functions of a government over to employers and other corporations.
Yes. Yes. It's the outsourcing.
So
and it's...
In that case, I know that Roberts, you know, people always say, well, Roberts, will buy himself some credibility like he did with the Obamacare decision. But, I'm not really, I would be more surprised if Roberts ruled the right way on Hobby Lobby than his majority than the ACA. I'm just not that up.
I'll tell you what I'm really worried about, to be honest with you, is that agency fee case on the unions. But we will talk about that next week. Josh, have a good weekend.
Happy Shabbat, Sam.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's Josh.
No Shabbat for me.
Former Majority Report senior producer emeritus. KC Humanist, the Philip Murawski interview was fascinating. I immediately bought his book. Have you seen Adam Curtis BBC documentaries, The Trap and Loving Grace? No, but I have
Trap is brilliant and Century of the Self is great.
Reverse Engineer, this IM is not sent through the app or AIM. If I can get any of the JavaScript packages to work, would you be interested in a free non-AIM IM page for the website? Yes.
Cool.
I don't know how you did that, sneaky reverse engineer guy, but yes, absolutely. That would be great. That would actually be great.
That'd be pretty damn cool.
Danny.
Just go to the website to IM us. Imagine that. Imagine being able to say that. That'd be...
Yep. Danny, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. That's Upton Sinclair. Thank you. Macintologist, remember the Senate did the same thing with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms 4 years ago at the behest of the NRA. That's right. Matt Marr, 83. Let me get this straight. John Bonair is suing the President Obama for not executing the laws that Bonair hasn't passed? Indeed. Well, you know, that whole lawsuit is a joke. We'll talk more about it probably in the future. Dr. Radmanthes, Sam, we empowered Islamist radicals when we funded the Mujahideens against the Soviets. We did it when we established. It's not so much the Mujahideens. It was not the Mujahideens with the problem, is that we started the madrasas in Pakistan.
The Saudis started the madrasas.
And we funded the madrasas.
Not directly. That was funded by the Saudis.
We did it when we destabilized Iraq and later when we allied ourselves with them in Libya. I contest that. We are about to do it by giving money to their rebellion in Syria across a porous border from their allies in ISIS. When will we learn our lesson? One begins to wonder.
Those guys are not allies of ISIS. They've been fighting internally. I mean, you got to make these distinctions, even within the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen in the 80s were hundreds of different groups. And then we basically let the Pakistanis and the Saudis run it, and they picked the most right-wing ones. There's no doubt about that.
One begins to wonder if our foreign policy is really pro-destabilization as much as our foreign policy establishment talks about stability in the Middle East and Africa. In any case, we cause many unintended destabilizing effects every time we intervene. Well, all right. I mean, we didn't intervene in Syria. And it seems to me that it's created instability. So, I agree with you. I think there's real problems sending $500 million there to, to vetted people. But the fact of the matter is we have the counterfactual, right? We didn't do really any of that. And to the extent that we did it in Syria, it was rather small and late. Even after we announced it, it still took months and months for anything to get there. And it turned out to be destabilizing. So, all right, I got to get going. Dead Guy Chuck, don't know if you got any noir recommendations today, but I highly recommend Brother Outsider, the gay civil rights activist, Bayard Rustin. I will check it out. Will you write that down for me, Brother Outsider? Obama and Cheney. Sam, can you say the phrase blow the lid off this airport in New York City without having your door kicked in? I don't know. Zorro Narkom, the SCOTUS reasoning for protecting people's rights to firebomb and throw blood at women is terrible, and Scott is living with blinders on if he doesn't recognize how big the SCOTUS buffer zone is. I'm so sick of this, tired of this agree to disagree mentality. Well, I didn't get that, but I can't read the whole thing because I got to get going. Militant apathy. Did the Mississippi GOP primary barrel sing new leverage for African Americans? Not just no, but hell no. I want to see how the GOP actually pulled this off and what deals were made. Josh is right about Roberts, except for the fact that Yam Bang was rioting during the 2000 Florida recount. That's true. Jay-Z, Sam's pronunciation of Worcester is reasonably correct by Old English standards, too. That being said, I suspect his pronunciation of Worcestershire will be way off. Yorick. Just speculating here, but perhaps the constitutional argument for keeping the buffer zone around the SCOTUS but striking others down would be that the protesters at the SCOTUS would have the possibility of influencing the justices or compromising their impartiality, whereas women seeking entrance to clinics aren't just going to be deciding policy. I don't know. Just spitballing. Jay Tingle, you mean it's not Wooster but Worcester? I heard Lemieux and immediately wondered what country he's from. XRX, going to look for work in an IKEA. Being in Westchester means I'll be making about $14 an hour, according to that MIT calculator. Hopefully it'll be a full-time gig. Not being sarcastic about that, especially about that last bit. It's evident from what I've seen looking for work that many of these retail shops only hire people part-time. Garen, I'm not on Facebook, but I will start following Guy more closely, along with Juan Cole. He's one of the best interviewees you've had on the show. With this crowd here, you are two for two. Hope that helps yesterday's whooping somewhat. I am Boxer. If the NLRB effectively ceases to exist, won't that cut both ways? No, because it is built to execute laws that largely support labor. Bartleby, how long before this buffer zone decision results in violence or bloodshed? These people have no shame. That's a horrible but good question. Massachusetts SWAT teams claim they're private corporations. Read more at Max Kaiser.
That's been covered broadly. We should get on that.
Okay. The genius says, that's going to piss off Bush and Chains what you said. The final I am of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Matt and Mike will be here Monday. I will be back on Tuesday, at least with with an interview, a pre-taped interview, and then Matt and Mike will be doing, then see you on Wednesday. All right. Genius says Bandar Bush has done more to destabilize Syria and the general Levant area than just about any other single individual. Talk to you next week.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive,